Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
What's good, internet? It is January 23rd, 2017. I'm Austin Walker coming to you, not live, coming to you on tape, fresh to tape, in, I don't know what we're going to call this place. Like, right now, it's
the
just
library?
Like... It's not. It does kind of look like a lot, like a
it's
study
be
room.
A library. The study.
This looks like a study room in a library,
yeah.
Like a campus library.
Yeah.
It kind of looks like
a campus.
Yeah, this is bad. We're not gonna. we're in the studio in production. We're in a room that has too much glass in it, which is why I'm a little echoey. And then it's also too tall, and there's no sound baffling it. There's like one wall.
But it's our room.
But it's our well,
that's, well sort of. It's like 75% our room.
It's like a timeshare. We got like a timeshare on the studio, where we get it like sometimes, but it's gonna be more than the last play at the Brick House. I like the Brick House.
We're, Shout out to the Brick House for like 6 hours a week.
Right, exactly. So, and that was we have to use that very tightly. Whereas this, we're going to have it for like at least 6.5 hours per week.
You're right, yeah.
Joining me, as always, Danielle Riendo here in the empty library,
the campus reading room. Campus for now. I don't know. We'll figure it out.
Patrick Klepek also joining me from Chicago.
Hey, we made it.
We did it. We sure fucking did.
I mean that like in the broadest sense possible.
Me too. Me too. In fact, Danielle, you were at a march this weekend.
Yes, I was at the New York City March, so I was in Midtown. It was pretty bananas at first, because I don't think they were expecting as many people as showed up. So you were in, like, a human pen for a while, but then once things opened up, they actually opened up Fifth Avenue and, like, shut down Midtown, and it was amazing to march, like, down Fifth Avenue with... just the incredible, incredible diversity of humanity that was there. There were a lot of little kids, which was super, super wonderful. And there were a lot of older people, which made me so happy. A lot of older women who, you know, hearing snippets of conversation. I actually forgot my phone, so I was marching by myself. You know, not by myself, with these, you know,
you're all alone.
Almost a million people.
Yeah, you went to a different part of the city.
All alone.
And it's like, I'm doing my own march.
Yeah. I was marching in Soho. Yeah, no. There were a lot of older women who were talking about being in marches in the 60s and 70s and being like, we're here again. Like, it was really inspiring to be around, like, older ladies.
Who've, like, done this shit. I mean, that's the thing I thought about a lot over the last couple of weeks is, like, and especially over the weekend, was that America has a history of protest and of resistance. And a lot of that has unfortunately not happened in our lifetimes, right? That, like, you go back to the
Vietnam protests. You go back to the 70s, basically.
You gotta go back to the 70s, exactly, to the last time that people were
in the streets. Occupy Wall Street is not, you know, that's what people think is protest in the modern age, and that is not.
Which is frustrating in some ways because there was something at the heart of Occupy that was, like, really powerful, and it just didn't organize in the way that it did here. And there's all sorts of really interesting conversations to be had about why this was felt more organized and more peaceful and less didn't have the same sort of aggressive police presence. There's all sorts of really interesting conversations that we probably don't have the time to get into today.
That's for the next politics.
That's the next politics cast.
Yeah.
But I am really excited. I was really happy with the turnout at the very least.
Oh,
and in general, like, I think everyone I know is in a slightly more optimistic mood. I don't like maybe just seeing a Nazi get punched Chinese people.
What it made me feel good about was, like, it's nice to know there are ways, like, even in the darkness, to find, like, a way that, like, feels like it gives you a flashlight going forward.
Yeah.
And so it's like, even when things get bad, it's like, remember what that was like, because we're probably going to have to do that a bunch.
A bunch. And that's the thing. That's the thing I hope happens, right, is that, like in the 70s, like in the 60s, protest can't be like – it's not like voting for a president. You can't bring that thing of just – you can't bring that like, oh, once every 4 years we're going to show up. Like, no, like, we need you guys to keep – if you're interested in anything political, you have to maintain activity.
It's like a subway punch card. Like, you can't – you got to show up a bunch of times to get the gift at the end. You can't just do it once.
Thank you.
You need your five sandwiches. That's what it is. You need to get all five.
Finally, you've broken down protest into a consumer analogy that we can understand in these times.
So, or like Jimmy John's, Chipotle, I don't know, pick your fast food restaurant of choice.
Yes, right, exactly. Pick your political spectrum, wherever you're at the political spectrum, whether you're a Subway person or a Jimmy John's person, or maybe you're a Pizza Hut, or maybe you want to book it. I want to book it.
Yeah, that's, book it was great.
That's what I want. So I'm going to keep reading
books.
Read
your books, book, eat your
get
pizza.
Get my sticker, get my free personal pan pizza. In this case, personal pan pizza is an analogy for healthcare. It's ironic, because if I keep eating personal pan pizzas, I'm going to need some health
care. You're going to need extra health care. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, this weekend was very helpful. I marched on Saturday, and then I was on my ambulance on Sunday, and it was like a thing where it was like, okay, there can be good things in this world. I was feeling pretty bad before this weekend. I'm not going to lie.
Being on the ambulance really helped. That's,
it really
did. I appreciate it. That's
it really
a good,
did.
We need more people like you, Danielle. Patrick, speaking of flashlights in the dark, looking forward.
Wow.
You played Resident Evil 7.
I finished Resident Evil 7.
You did? Oh. Awesome. What did you think?
It's tremendous. I've never been more nervous putting in a video game in like a long time. There are very few franchises that like sort of mean something to me, but the only video game poster I have in my house is of the original Resident Evil for like one of the original posters for that game when it came out on the PlayStation back in 1996, and it just defined a lot of like my youth and my taste and like my interest in horror movies going forward. Like a lot of that is like traced back directly to Resident Evil. And that series just got so bad over the years and so up its own ass and so convoluted. And
did you ever fuck with like the Resident Evil Revelations games, which I heard were
Yeah, the last one wasn't that bad, but it's like it's convincing yourself in like a sea of like a swamp that like there's this one dry spot and I'll just come hang out over there and like it's okay.
And pretend I'm not in a swamp, right?
Exactly.
But you are.
And that series, like what they've done, you know, it actually follows the Resident Evil games follow a trajectory that's actually similar to other horror narratives. It's like once like the first one is interesting because it's all mystery, it's all suspense, it's all like reveals, but then as something like that goes on, horror films tend to tilt towards the absurd and tilt towards action in the same way that the Resident Evil games did. But what Resident Evil did was every once in a while it was sort of revolutionary in terms of how it even approached that stuff. So Resident Evil 2 was sort of like, you know, the aliens to Alien from Resident Evil to Resident Evil 2. Then Resident Evil 4, you know, like completely reinvents what we expect from an action game. And then it kept going down that path, 4, 5, 6. And I know 5 has its defenders. That can be part of my Resident Evil cast where I yell at people about Resident Evil 5.
It's not terrible.
That's a low bar. It's a great co-op game. That's like the one thing I'll give Resident Evil 5.
It's fun.
Resident Evil 6 is just 30 hours of just like 30 hours. Like, I played once I got 10 hours in, I said, I need to go all the way. I have to see how this ends. I have a terrible habit of doing that, but I did.
Was it worth it for you?
Definitely not. But I can say I did it, so no one's allowed to come to me and be like, yo, like the 28th hour of Resident Evil 6 is where finally it all makes sense.
It doesn't? Does that not happen? It
doesn't make sense.
Huh.
And what Resident Evil 7 does is it technically takes place after the first six games, but for folks that maybe fell off the track of Resident Evil, for folks that got, like me, got so fed up with the convoluted mythology, it's a clean break. It is set after the sixth game, but no returning characters, settings.
Really? So there's no surprises for old. Are there little hints?
There are Easter eggs. It acknowledges like the history that it is from, and
like the Raccoon City incident happened. That's a thing that happened in the past.
Yeah, like I'm cautious for like people that are fans. Yeah, I don't want to go anywhere near like what it does touch on, but like I just want to make the point that like, from a gameplay perspective and from a narrative perspective, they just said, look, we're not going to pretend this other stuff didn't come before, but we're going to do our best to set it in a place that allows us to kind of ignore that. And they do that by putting you in the middle of a house in Louisiana that is separate from everything else. They turn it first person. They embraced VR. And what they do is what I loved about Resident Evil 1 was the sense of isolation. Like, you truly felt alone in this weird mansion where you didn't know where things were going on. You had very little to grasp onto. Like, the reason it was called survival horror was because for large parts of that game, you really didn't have enough bullets to feel safe. You constantly felt on edge. And for at least the first half of this game, they completely 100% recapture all of that.
Which is it's amazing to me that they did that, and also that your response is really positive, not because it's undoable, but because there's actually been a rise in that sort of gameplay design bounced back in the independent horror game community over the last, like, 5 years, where there have been a lot of games in which you're under-equipped and assaulted and running and fearful, and you don't have weapons, or you don't have enough weapons, you don't have enough ammo. Like, that's become a hallmark of a certain sort of horror game design. So it's cool to see that they then went back to it. It doesn't just feel like they're biting that style, but they were, like, returning to their home.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, there are, like, a couple pivot points in horror design of, like, the last 10 years. Like, Amnesia, The Dark Descent was a big one, which says, hey, let's take away weapons, and it's just – it's about the atmosphere. It's about surviving without access to weapons in order to survive. And then Alien Isolation is sort of, like, right. the pinnacle of, like, of that. It's, like, it's taken from the independent space and, like, brought with, like, all the spectacle of AAA. And that game has its own problems, but I think it, like, sort of puts a pin on, like – where to take that one particular idea, like, sort of all the way through. Totally. And then there has been this conversation once, like, that game arrived, like, well, maybe guns are cool, guys. Like, maybe we took this too far. And that's sort of what Resident Evil 7 does, is says, look, like, just the existence of your ability to fight back against what's around you doesn't necessarily negate the game of tension. And they do a right. really fantastic job in the first half of, like, really wringing that out, of making you, like... Like, I'm wandering around where, like, I'm using the VR helmet to look around corners so that I can, like, try and get a sense of what's ahead. I'm running away from enemies and not fighting them. I'm shutting doors so that I don't have to take them on.
Did you pretty much only play in VR?
I did a mixture. When I first got the game, I play a lot. My wife is also deeply into horror, so I at least wanted her to see what the game was.
Right.
And so I played the opening hours without VR. And what's striking about that is the game is such a high fidelity. Like, it's not quite PT level, you know, where you've got one hallway that has, like, an ultra, like, this immaculate detail. But Resident Evil 7 is just a gorgeous, like, gothic looking game. And when you put on the VR headset, you lose a lot of that. Now, you trade that for
being able to look around corners.
Yeah. Being able to look around corners for the immersion,
isolated,
the 3D.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Like, it's the trade-off is absolutely worth it. But when I would go back to the other way and watching it on a standard screen, it would bum me out a little bit because I'd be reminded of what I was missing. But I think the trade-off is totally worth it. And I think there's also reason to think, you know, as VR sets get better, that, like,
right,
you know,
sure.
a couple evolutions of this on the PC side, you're going to be able to get that one-to-one in a way that would be pretty incredible.
This is the first, like, big substantial VR joint. Like, is this – has there been something that's like, oh, yeah, I can play this whole thing through. It's either in VR or not, and both are compelling but also distinct like this. Mm-hmm.
Pretty much.
I'm saying is this the killer app for VR?
Put it. I mean, I would say, like, if you're on the fence, like, if you were thinking about it, and if this game has any sort of appeal to you, the VR is the way to play it. Like, I it's not saying it's not going to be enjoyable on Xbox One and PC, although I presume that PC modders will very quickly patch in VR support, even if that's not officially included by Capcom at the start. But it is the way to play the game. Like, if you can wait, like, it's not a game that's going to get spoiled for you. Like, there's not some big twist or pivot. There are revelations, they explain things as stuff goes on, but there's nothing about this that, like, will be spoiled 6 months from now if for some reason you can find a way to sit on it and play
right.
in virtual reality, because I think it is better that way. What's weird about it, though, is so the demo, I'm not sure if either of you played the demo.
Kitchen or the other demo?
Did you play it in VR?
Yes.
And so when it made me incredibly nauseous to the point that I almost couldn't finish the demo. Was that the case for you, Danielle?
Weirdly, no. And that's
I feel like you were an outlier.
Because I've definitely gotten nauseated mm-hmm. in VR before. But this, for whatever reason, maybe because when I play horror games, I, like, stand in place a lot and, like, just sort of very slowly look around. I get very, very paranoid. It might be that I'm a weirdo, is what I'm saying.
Well, what's interesting is that I've had no experience with VR sickness whatsoever. Like, it's never been a thing for me. It's just never been something that's, like, been an obstacle for me with the technology. But the Resident Evil 7 demo, like, I almost had to tell the when I played at E3 last year, I had to almost tell them, like, hey, take it off. Like, I can't get through this. There was something
on your headset.
There's something about the way it handles movement that just immediately set my stomach off. And so when you play Resident Evil 7 in VR, immediately the way they clearly, there was a big pushback against the VR, because there was a lot of folks were getting sick that weren't getting
yeah.
sick in other VR things. It was a pretty obvious trend in a lot of folks that were playing the game. So by default, when you put on a VR headset, the game doesn't actually have you move. So you move forward and backwards in real time.
Analog sticks?
Yeah, with the analog sticks. You can go, okay. You go forward and go backward just fine. You can look around, obviously. But to shift left or right, by default, it happens at 30-degree intervals. So it doesn't happen in real time.
Oh,
so it essentially snaps you 30 degrees left and right. Now, you can go in to the options menu and turn that off. You can make it, you know, real time so that you're slowly shifting left and right.
Right.
As soon as I did that, immediate nausea. It came back. So they didn't actually change anything in how they're – or at least it's not clear that they changed anything in how they're displaying the game or how they were handling movement. They instead just found a solution that gets rid of you doing the shifting to left to right. Because what's happening is like...
So you're saying when it snaps you, when you say it moves you 30 degrees, is it like in a snap?
It's or instantaneous. Is it like, it's like you're shifting to a different scene in an adventure game. Like you're like,
wow.
Snap, 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 snap. It's really bizarre at first, but you get over it. It's actually only a problem when you're... sort of facing like multiple enemies or a boss where you need to be like running around a lot, and it's kind of frustrating to line things up. But by and large, I got over it pretty quickly. And I'm going to be curious if modders find a way to find a more
to
better
smooth that
because,
out
because it's not the ideal way to play the game. I wish I had been able to move things in real time and have full control over the character, but I didn't really end up. And you can actually make the degrees. You can make it 20 degrees, 40 degrees. I don't think you can get more granular than that. But if your 30 degrees isn't enough, you can make it 40, which is interesting.
It's interesting that is what eliminates nausea, like having it snap. It almost sounds like counterintuitive in terms of like, I think like, oh, snapping sounds almost like, oh, God, okay, now I'm going to barf. But it sounds like they found some kind of solution.
A lot of my occasional VR sickness has been around feeling my head thinking that there should be motion in my body where there isn't any, and I could see if it's just too smooth and too convincing in that way, having it move slowly and actually pivot could totally fuck you up that way.
Yeah.
Or like, no, or doing it fast, like my brain is able, this is a complete conjecture, but it's able to be like, okay, this is artifice. Someone built this. I'm not looking at real life. Right. I'm looking at pretend.
Yeah.
My brain is fine. My brain gets that. My body doesn't expect motion, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense.
It's weird. It's a weird thing.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's the solution that worked for me, and like I said, I played it for about 5 minutes and thought, well, this is fucked. Like, this is not how I want to play the game.
Right.
But I got over it really quickly, and also, again, like, it was a form of compromise where the immersion of being in the game, putting on headphones, and, like, just being in that space with the VR headset just was really unlike anything else I've played, and it was to the point where, like, again, you know, I'm sort of framing the game as a first half and second half, and I'm not going to get into really my problems with the second half because that's a conversation for once this game is out there and more people have played it.
But you don't think that's whatever your problems are aren't so big that you're like holding back your recommendation?
No, like the enthusiasm for the first half is like so effusive that like the problems of the second half, like in the most truncated Vegas terms, are that it ends up going back on some of Resident Evil's worst tendencies from the last couple of games.
Gotcha.
In a way that the first half is like very grounded about being and focused about you being stuck in this house with a fucked up family and you don't know what's going on. And like it's just a lot of the mystery. It's like a lot of horror. Like the mystery is the fun part when you start to to get to the center of the onion. Like it's not necessarily as interesting as when you got started. Not a perfect metaphor.
The zombie onion, when you get to the center of the undead onion.
It gets
onion.
A little rotten in the middle.
There you go.
You know, that's it.
Okay. But just, the switch to first person, like everything about it is just, I'm so excited that they decided to do something as bold as this because it clearly paid off creatively for them.
That's like, even nice. As someone who's like a fair weather Resident Evil fan like myself, I'm excited that they're doing cool new shit. Like that's just always going to get me excited is when a big company takes a risk because that's not a thing that you see that often in the AAA space anymore. And so when I swing for the fences and you'll impress me at least a little bit. And so I'm glad that they did that. Though I guess, you know, that Resident Evil 6 was also them swinging for the fences. And
they swung for a fence.
They were swinging for different fences.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Knowing what your thing is like a really tough challenge, I think, when you have a big budget. And so I appreciate that they like took the time to say, like, okay, what do we want Resident Evil to be again? And, like, they found it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, I think there was a, you know, an argument could be made that as the series went on, like, they, what Capcom thought Resident Evil was, you know, like, big spectacle, like, Umbrella Corporation, things were Resident Evil, and like really what Resident Evil was, like at its core, was like, you know, isolation in a place that is scary and realized,
a place that feels like it has, like, it, not realistic, but like it feels compelling because it's every room feels distinct and like a room, not like a first person shooter where sometimes it feels like the rooms only exist to get shot up.
Yeah.
Right. Like,
yeah, they're just combat scenarios. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Whereas like every dining room in, you know, or every bathroom, every little room. Oh, right. That's the room with the statue in it. Like, you can make those. That's so much of what my early like fandom around not just Resident Evil, but like interesting survival horror games had always been around. Like, I'm going to divide this place up into rooms in my head. Clock Tower did that. Like, so many games, yeah. Which has like an adventure game background too. Of just like, okay, here's the scene. Cool, here it is in my head. I really like the stuff that I do in that room. I'll solve that puzzle. Like that stuff was all really cool. So glad to see that they're dipping their toes back into that direction. I hope that they do something else cool after this. Like, I hope that they keep playing around in the same way, and that like we're not three games away from complaining about the new Resident Evil trilogy. It's getting stuck in its ways and being boring.
Yeah. Although I'll certainly take three games like, sure, this, you know, like if they do the same idea of just, hey, drop you off in some other corner of the Resident Evil universe that is cannot at what's happened but gets to do its own thing, like essentially be a sequel.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
But not be a sequel. And it's really, you know, your remarks about the sort of geography of the original games and other just sort of like survival horror games that by virtue of their contained spaces and their detailed spaces, like, force you to sort of not memorize, but just like you become so familiar.
Yeah, you internalize
because you are forced
it.
To, like, it is actually
like a real place.
Yeah, right. It is shocking how small Resident Evil 7 is. Like, it is unbelievable. Like, looking back on it, like, as I was examining the maps and, like, running it through in my head, like, it is a tiny game, but it's dense. And that's, like, the difference between, like, Resident Evil 1 and Resident Evil 6 is, like, is Resident Evil 6 is throwing everything at the wall, and you're constantly moving from section to section where
running
nothing
on rooftops
is memorable. They're just spaces that you're going through, and weird shit happens. Like, Resident Evil 1 and Resident Evil 7, what they focus on, it's a different approach. It's not as much as an action game, but it's a sense of, like, every room matters, and, like, you're combing through them. And, like, I can, in my head, walk through all of Resident Evil 7 and tell you exactly where each path goes and, like, what it leads to. And I found that to be, like, a real hallmark of a survival horror game where it's, like, I can do that in my head.
There was a moment, all this is making me remember that I've, some part of me has wanted this Resident Evil game for a decade. Did you ever beat the first Condemned?
Yeah, loved Condemned. Right.
So the first Condemned ends with this, like, I'm going to spoil the end of the first Condemned.
That's fine.
Well, I'm not going to spoil the very end.
Throwing my headphones off right now. No, okay. It's okay. Go ahead.
You should really spoil the end of Condemned 2, because that is the much weirder one.
I think they both actually, you're right, Condemned 2 has the weirdest ending of any game ever. People should go look that up.
Yep.
The actual end of Condemned 1 also goes there. If I don't know if you're like, all of a sudden, like, what is happening? Why are these weird enemies I'm fighting? But before it makes that weird, like, supernatural twist, there's a boss fight inside of a single house. Against like a slasher film like killer, basically, who's chasing you around the house, and you're kind of chasing him around the house, and that's after you've spent some time investigating the house and trying to like piece together some clues. It's only like, you know, the investigation probably takes 30 minutes, and then the boss fight is probably, you know, 15 minutes or something. But playing that game a decade ago, I remember leaving it going like, this is a game, this whole thing is a game, like, build cool weird little like houses that are creepy and like that you get really intimately familiar with, because what you ended up doing in that boss fight was like, I know this geography better than you. And he, of course, that's not true because the other thing was an AI and right. it knows it like as well as anything can know it. But like that was how to succeed. It meant reaching a certain level of mastery of understanding what hallways connected to what, where the stairwell goes, stuff like that. Almost Hitman style of like, okay, oh, yeah. I know the geography here. I can utilize that. And so, like, any time a game asks me to have that is already cool, but then to do that and also have it be really scary is fucking great. So I'm excited to check out Resident Evil 7.
I can't wait.
The one last point I'll make is and I mentioned this in my write-up, is that it's smart about, like, and this is a non-mythology speaking, but how it nods at its history, which is to say they don't necessarily in this game completely get away from sort of the bizarre, esoteric puzzles from previous games.
How many eagle keys do I get? How many?
There's a lot of
gems. I remember the gems.
There's a lot of stuff like that without getting into what exactly you're doing, because the discovery of that is some of the fun. What it gets away from is making those a pain in the ass to solve. But
awesome.
What the game does is it incorporates them as a way of making this house seem very strange and weird. But it's also a nice nod to people who've been with the series for that long to realize, like, oh, right, like, I've seen a crest on a door before.
Yeah.
And
but like when you actually think through that, it's actually fucking weird, right? Like if you woke up in a house today and you had to find like a weird like marble like claw and put it into a wall or some bullshit. You'd be like, whoever built this house is fucked up. Like
So there is, you know, and the one thing I'll say to this, and I'll end my point here because otherwise I'm gonna get too close into wanting to talk about my things that it actually does, is that one of your first encounters with something like this, like the most Resident Evil thing from the 90s, your character just openly remarks, like, who builds shit like this?
Good.
And it's like, it's just exactly what people have been like saying in their head about this series that they love, and also go, who builds this shit? And it's just,
nice.
It's like the benefit of having a rich history and mythology and like built-in knowledge. Like that's the benefit of having something like that. And it's them deploying that in a smart, funny, interesting way without getting bogged down in the bad parts of it that they have often found themselves falling
into
over the years.
Rare instance where they both lampshade their own history while also correcting it.
Totally.
So that it actually is better. Right. Yeah. That's cool.
Totally.
Oh,
it sounds so good.
That sounds good.
Highly recommend.
I don't have a clean pivot here other than I also have a game I think I recommend.
Yep.
Or at least I recommend, like you, I think the first half I have a few surprise about, which is I beat Gravity Rush 2.
You beat a video game.
I beat Gravity Rush 2. Patrick, I think you also played through it.
I did, yeah. I was like in a rush to try and finish that before
a rush.
Resident Evil 7.
A Gravity Rush. I was in a rush too.
Well, you just made it worse.
The gravity of the situation.
I quit.
Of this entire thing.
Fucking quit. That game is fucking good. It's also, that game makes the worst first. Gravity Rush 2 just came out on PS4. It makes the worst first impression. Like,
oh,
I think the first three or four hours.
Of like a game of maybe the past 5 years.
If I didn't just trust, like it took a deal of faith I haven't had in a long time. I don't have another pun. I'm drained thinking about the beginning of this game. So like this is a game that eventually gets to places that are like bright and colorful, and it's all about like moving through the air in a combination of fall and dance and flight, and like the beginning of that game is literally you stomping around like a metal diving suit. And then like you don't even get your, and like that alone I'm not going to diss. Cause I think like the juxtaposition between like, oh, I couldn't move fast to like, oh boy, I fly is really cool. But it just takes a long time to go from that to you flying around and then to you flying around in places you actually give a fuck about. Like the whole introductory arc is just kind of rough. But if you get to that first city, like it is joyous in a way that like I wrote about Diaries of a Spaceport Janitor, where like music and life and the it's bright and colorful and the kind of architecture of the city. So I guess I'll back up a little bit. Gravity Rush is a game in which you play as this character named Kat who can control gravity, but she doesn't have like a complete control over it in the sense that she could just fly around like Superman. She just kind of like looks at a place and goes like, "Oh, that's where gravity is now. I'm gonna fall."
And just kind of propels her way there. Yes. Like she flails. Like as you fly in the sky, she's not elegant. She's literally just sort of like waving her arms and legs around.
Yeah. Exactly. Every now and then she'll like, you'll boost and like, she'll like, well, I'm going to steady myself and like look kind of cool for a second, but it never really gets to where she's like Superman or Neo at the end of the Matrix or something. Do you know what I mean? Like, she's always just falling, which is great. Yeah. And so the first game came out only on the Vita and had a kind of a limited,
they did audience. A remaster on the PS4.
Yeah, they did that remaster.
Correct. Sorry, my
About
bad.
About a year ago.
And I think that game was like, that game took place in a really cool looking city too. And the mechanics were really fun. But I think that this, I don't know, I guess I don't want to just say it's like more of the same, but I think the things that it really still has from that first game are like, it's fun to be in that world and to deal with the characters in that universe. The flight just feels good. The fighting is like not especially deep or anything, but it moves at a pace and with like enough. There's enough variety in how you want to like get through a fight that you never feel like you're having like, you're never in a slog. It's never just like a boring beat 'em up.
Nice. Yeah.
Cuz I'm always able to just like, okay, I'm going to like hop on that building really quick and then like charge up a super attack and like nose dive into this crowd of weird enemies and blow them all up. So I beat that game 2 nights ago and I still feel unresolved about it in the way that feels. I get that feeling a lot when I beat a game I wish I could spend more time with. And I ended up feeling that way here of just like I wanted to be in that world longer, even though I think it has some problems in terms of like side quest design can be a little boring every now and then, or like a little repetitive or a little mundane. I still like want to just have the cutscenes in that game happening and still want to be able to fly from one of these giant city centers to another. I kind of like got off my point there, but like the thing I actually wanted to get to is like these cities are like broken up into districts like cities are in video games and often in real life, but they're not attached to the ground, right? Like everything in the world, I mentioned this a few episodes ago, is floating. Everything in the world is unanchored from the ground. And so there, it's just like, oh, here is like the cool entertainment district. And then like over there on a different floating fucking island is the industrial zone or whatever.
Yeah. Or like if you go up at the very top is the military industrial complex of this area.
So I'll say nice. This, like the game has already, you know, obviously this is a thing that's known already, that the Gravity Rush 2 has both this new city in it and also the city from the first game, Hexville.
Okay.
And what's really incredible to me is that like the new city is so much more interesting in its design because it leans into verticality in a different way. Where, like Patrick said, at the very top, it's like, oh, the military base, which is also just like a huge military gunship, is way above everything else. And then like a little bit under that is like the business district or like the kind of like super wealthy area. And then a little bit under that is the like marketplace and kind of like the middle class. And then like deep under cloud cover.
You really got to fall for a long time.
That moment to me was like, that was so fucking good, right?
Yeah.
You know, Patrick, you and I have been talking about trying to write about this at some point. You send me a letter today, I'll kick it off, and we'll try to write about it. But Guardians Wars 2 hits class in a way that I did not expect even a little bit.
That's rad.
You know, you show up to this, you do the intro, which is like very anime and very like you're on this trade ship, basically. You're on this ship of people
is
who.
Is the Galaxy Cat still there? I just need to hear.
Yes.
Okay, great.
Dusty is still there.
Dusty.
And you're like mining for ore, basically. You're part of this like group that does that. And then eventually the story leads you into this first city. And you're like, oh, wow, what a cool, bright place. Like, everything is great. And then eventually you're trying to, like, track down someone who stole some of the ore that you'd mined. And it's like, oh, yeah, they must be down in whatever the name of the undertown is.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, okay, I guess I'll just go down there. And, like, you look for it. Like, I don't see it anywhere. I have a mark on my map that says to go 2,000 meters or whatever down. And, like, there's just clouds down there. Like, I think if I fall, I'm going to die. And you fall and you fall and you fall and you fall. And, like, it goes. Like, that distance is so smart and good yeah. at communicating how far away these people are from, like, what the life, the bright,
the
colorful.
Bright, happy.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. Kind of like the postcard version of that city is. And then you finally get down there and it's like slums all hanging off of each other on these things that are precariously placed. They all feel like they're going to fall at any second. And that moment is really good. And then like it doesn't back down from that shit. And again, we'll write about that this week, Patrick, nice. So I don't want to get too deep into it. But like,
yeah, but it's just surprising. It could have, if it had just done the aesthetic choice
right.
of like dividing up the, you know, using the city design to stratify class and like display that in like a way that's a very tangible aesthetically.
Yeah.
Like that would have been interesting in and of itself. But
and then,
where it goes like beyond that is like actually having both the main storyline and like some of the best side quests are the stuff that have you interacting between the classes and and it was, you know, we'll probably get into this in our letters, but you know, the fact that like the character of like Kat, like she's not super developed. There's not a lot her. She's
right. And
She's mostly is like a blank slate, but she's like she's also like very cheery and optimistic and wants to help people. And so she, what makes her an interesting contrast to the rest of the world is that in a society with a lot of class, like people sort of know what their class is and what their like quote unquote rank is, and like they kind of operate there. And whereas Kat comes in and like interacts with everyone and just doesn't understand like why are the rich people being dicks to like the nice people down below? And like she's just so oblivious and ignorant to it in a way that's it's really charming because she just wants to help people. And so then as a player, you get to interact between those classes, and your character revolts in a way that's a little bit different than the way that Kat does. But it's she provides like a nice perspective into the world because she comes in without sort of any preconceived notions of who these different people are,
which ends up being really interesting too, because you know that was a game before I even got to the class stuff, but even throughout I kind of was always just like, fucking Kat, you have got to stand up for yourself a little bit. People are just constantly asking you to do some shit and like not get credit for it or whatever. And also is like that blank slate character who they do a good job of it. At one hand, like kind of shouting out her ability to not have any prejudices, but also in that story specifically, they don't make the mistake of falling into the trap of saying like, well, both sides are good. Like her takeaway isn't like, but the rich people were nice to me too. It's like, like push come to shove, I have to take a stand here and like make a choice. And that was actually really cool to see them lean into it that way, or like to actually follow through on what was already pretty good. And that, so that was a big surprise. And then like, I just also think that that game does scale in a way that is exceptional. That's a game that, despite being bright and cheery, made me like gasp occasionally at the way it was willing to lean into scale and character design and the bosses. Like the bosses in this game are fucking unbelievable.
It's funny, nice. As much as I like the Gravity Rush games, I despise them because they have taken the creator of the series away from the horror franchise Siren, which is also responsible for.
And
he's been upset that he hasn't been able to make any horror games while he's made the Gravity Rush games. And in this game specifically, like you can see it seeping out. Like you can see where he's like driven up a wall by the fact that he hasn't.
Out there.
There are some creatures in this game where you're like, bro, go make a horror game, because like it's just seeping out of you at this point.
Unbelievable. There was a bit when I was playing it a couple nights ago where I like put the controller and I was like, what is happening?
Without getting into like what is actually happening, there's specifically a boss that is like city size attached to a building that you're just like, fuck, man, even beating it was gross.
Yes. Well, and that's the thing that they do so well throughout is like, I going back to the thing that we were talking about with Resident Evil 7 and becoming familiar with the location, the thing that Gravity Rush 2 does again and again and again is it makes you super familiar with the location and then it fucks it up. And so like you get an intuitive feeling for like where the clock tower is or where the military gunship is supposed to be or something like that. And like when that stuff shifts in some way because of the story, it feels really cool. I think there's some weird stuff in it. Like again, like I think the final act is actually really strange and
I think your line that you messaged me, like, I think it's just bad. Like I think it ends poorly, but I think. Again, I don't want to get into spoilers because this game just came out, but your line to me that you sent privately, that was like, they seemed to realize they were probably not going to make a third game, and the last act of this game, where it all kind of falls apart and seems extremely rushed and just shoved into this game, it seems like they're acknowledging, like, there's probably a good chance we're not going to make another one of these, so let's just find a way to send it off.
That's like, get the lore dump out. Like, if you want to know about what the real shit is about this world, we're gonna just dump that in there.
Yeah.
And that's cool. Have fun. And I'm glad that they got that stuff out there, but also wish that they had not done it at all. I would have almost.
Yeah, because it makes the last like 6 hours feel like a real slog, as opposed to like there's sort of a natural end point for the game before it keeps going.
Credits roll. Yeah.
And it felt really good and was like a fine place to end. But I mean, even outside all that stuff, the game does all these really smart little pieces, especially for making you more familiar with the geography. There's this system that they have in where you treasures, I think they're called.
Yeah, treasures.
Which are basically like, occasionally there's a side quest that comes up where you have to use a photograph to that you get this tiny little photograph that shows you a tiny little slice of the world. And then if you find wherever that is, there's like a little apple that you can kick open. And sometimes there'll be a costume. Sometimes there'll be gems. Like there's just, you know, sort of stuff
treasure
to find. But like the reward is actually more about like solving the puzzle than it is.
OK, there's
actually
a billboard here and there's a big building, a water tower. Where is this? OK, it's within this radius. There it is. And that feels really good.
Nice.
That would be one thing if it was just that. But what's brilliant about it is the game dynamically places these throughout the environment.
Yeah.
And then it piggybacks off of players. So when you find a treasure, you have found that treasure. I assume this must all start with the developers took a photograph.
Yes.
But
yes.
Once a player has found that, the player then takes a photograph themselves with an in-game camera, and you're trying to show a hint for the next person who comes along. And you'll see in the corner while you're playing, like, hey, man, like, your buddy on your friend list just took a screenshot of this treasure. Like, do you want to go find that? So you'll click it, and it'll warp you over to that area. So, like, it puts you in a nice confined space so you know you don't have to go too far to
find
it.
Where it is, yeah.
But then, like, based on your friend's photograph, you have to try and find this item. And then once you find that item, you take a photograph, and it just kind of keeps perpetuating throughout the world. And as you're playing, you get notifications when other players find an item based on your photograph, which is just such a cool feeling.
That's a cool feeling. And it lets you, like, I don't know if you did this ever, Patrick, but, the camera system has a tripod. You can, like, do selfies, basically.
Yeah.
With it, and as you play and get more treasures, like the things you're getting are like more costumes, more props for your photos.
Yeah, you can lay down like boxes and like curtains and all this other weird shit in your photos.
It's such a fun little like, and it's so on point, so on tone with what that game is, which is fun and like it's all about like, oh, I have these weird abilities, I'm going to use it to be goofy and fun and help my friends and play, and like that's what that photo mode feels like, which is cool. So.
I cannot wait to play this. I have it sitting on my system right now. I cannot wait to play this.
It's really good. Unfortunately, I think we have to wrap now. I forgot that we have to go to a meeting.
There's a very important meeting.
There's an important Vice meeting. The Vice State of the Union is happening internally here today. So we are going to cut it early today. No question bucket, unfortunately. But
we'll
did a
extra
lot
bucket
of questions.
Next time.
We'll get the extra large bucket next time. It'll be great. Until then, I'm Austin Walker. You can find me on Twitter at Austin_Walker. Where can people find you, Danielle?
I'm Danielle R.I. on Twitter.
What about you, Patrick?
You can find me on Twitter at Patrick Klupik.
Awesome. You can find everything that Waypoint does at waypoint.vice.com, digitalpyramids.com, new.donk.city,
Bazinga.zone.
Bazinga.zone,
yeah.
Waypoint.zone. You already know what it is. Twitter.com/waypoint. You can find every video we do both on the website, but also this is a hot tip for those of you not in the United States. You can go to youtube.com/waypointvice, where none of our shit is region locked. We're working on the region locked stuff.
Yeah,
it's out of our hands. We're working on it.
Yeah, I'm doing my best. Trust.
That's why it's all on YouTube.
You can go to youtube.com/waypointvice and see everything there. Our stream archives. We have a Hitman archive up. Patrick has some Let It Die stuff up. And then finally, shout outs to Tim Barnes.
Yeah,
who
Tim
is producing the podcast.
The Last Jedi.
The Last Jedi of Audio.
Yes, he is the Last Jedi
That's true.
Of Audio.
The Last Jedi of Audio, Tim Barnes, TimBarnes451 on Twitter. And shout-outs to Bowen for letting us use his theme song, or use his song, Miss You, as our theme song off the EP Pale Machine, waypoint.zone/BOEN. You can find out more info about that there. We will see you on Friday. Have a good week. Peace.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.